Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there. The Republican House majority hanging by a thread, and NBC News contributor Ronna McDaniel also hanging by a thread. We'll discuss all this more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C. W. Cook, Noah Rothman, and the lapidary Ramesh Panuru. You are, of course, listening to a National View podcast. Our sponsor this episode is the University of Austin. More about them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, by the way, you can find us everywhere. From Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So Ramesh, the Republicans in the House are now down to a one-vote margin. They have been steadily losing members. You've had various folks announcing retirements, committee chairman and the like, most notably recently Ken Buck, who had announced he was going to retire, just said, I'm out of here, to try to line up Lauren Boebert in a one-on-one primary in the hopes that she will not be his successor. And then Mike Gallagher, this one was a gut punch, was announced a couple weeks ago, said he was going to leave as well, one of the most promising, maybe the most promising young Republican in the House, and he has gone such, the timing is such that there won't be a special election, and Republicans are just going to be down another seat until January. What do you make of it? What's going on?
This is going to be the first House majority in U.S. history that expires out of a sheer lack of will to live. A majority can be large or small, and it can be united or fractious. And the Republicans are currently in the one quadrant that doesn't work, small and fractious. And that, I think, is part of the reason why it has been just so unrewarding and really even kind of hellish, people say, to be serving in this majority. And you can't really tell yourself, if you're a House Republican who wants to achieve things legislatively, that at least you're doing a lot of good, because it's not obvious that you are. And so it becomes harder and harder to see why you should stick around.
Yeah. So Noah, something that they could also be looking at reliving is a speaker fight. We'll see. Marjorie Taylor Greene, in response to Johnson advancing this spending bill, which he needed to do to avoid a government shutdown and which didn't please conservatives because he needs Democratic votes and needs to get through a Democratic Senate and be signed by a Democratic president. Basically, this is the same exact situation as we discussed many, many times that Kevin McCarthy dealt with in exactly the same way. She's put the gun on the table, a motion to vacate. She says she's not going to push it yet, but the threat is there if he advances Ukraine funding in any form, that she would potentially drag the conference through this drama. Again, you have some Democrats now saying, actually, we would back Johnson, because we've seen this was not good for the institution, what happened the first time around with McCarthy, but this is something else hanging out there.
Well, I guess that's kind of heartening to hear, that maybe there are some institutionalists who are willing to put their political and partisan interests aside in order to preserve some functionality of this institution. Right now, it is dysfunctional because it has been handed over to people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, whose interests are personal and very parochial. There's a profound brain drain going on in the Republican conference, and it's not hard to see why. Nobody would want to subject themselves to this if they didn't have to. It's a grueling experience to be in Congress. It's not especially well remunerated. And you can do better in the private sector. And so people who are competent and capable of doing better in the private sector are taking advantage of that opportunity. I'm sympathetic to people who are frustrated with the minibus, for example, as a spending bill that passed with not even a majority of the majority Republican Party's support. There's a lot in there not to like. But it's better than what would have sailed through Congress to keep the lights on in the absence of a Republican majority, however small it is. And the rejoinder to those who say, like Mike Lee, who I sympathize with when he says, you know, we need Republicans who are better at pursuing our priorities. Sure, that means you need to win more elections. You need more Republicans in office. How do you go about doing that? I encountered last night a memo from the Dan Duncan, who's the president of the Republican State Leadership Committee, who advised Republican candidates in 2024 not to make the mistake that they made in the 2022 cycle. What was that mistake? According to Dan, they were just leaning too hard into Joe Biden. They're giving Joe Biden too much trouble here. We got to differentiate our message here, broaden our scope and our appeal. Republicans didn't lose because everybody can't get enough Joe Biden. Joe Biden was as unpopular in 2022 as he is today, perhaps more actually in the summer of 2022. The problem is multi-causal, obviously. Republicans didn't hit their targets in 2022 for a variety of reasons, but foremost among them is one they can't address, which is that they nominated a lot of candidates to offices in competitive races who did not reflect the will of their states and were beholden to the idea that 2020 was denied Donald Trump because of a grand, vast conspiracy. That stands out as the factor that correlates strongest with election losses in statewide and competitive races in places like Michigan, Arizona, Nevada, and Pennsylvania. And they can't address it. In fact, they're still clinging to it. Chris LaCivita, who's Trump's, one of his foremost professionals, and the CEO of LaCivita. Thank you. I've never heard it.
I don't know if it's going to have any effect on you, no, because I told you repeatedly it was Vivek, but you're always a Vivek guy.
I also say Nevada. I think it's Nevada. I can't help it. I'm a creature of habit in that way. But anyway, he's out there today saying, or yesterday saying, you know, they stole it last time. They're not going to get to do it this time. They're married to this narrative, and it is a millstone around their neck. Republicans need a bigger majority to be more effective in Congress. And what they're doing is preventing them from winning the elections. They need to be effective in Congress. Point blank.
Yeah, and this is the time when you should really be uncompromising and really try to pull stuff to the right is when you have a majority, right, of both houses and a Republican president. But you have this weird dynamic where when Republicans have unified control, all of a sudden, you know, the will to really control spending almost disappears. But then when they have a tiny majority in one chamber of Congress, then all of a sudden it's a matter of the utmost principle. So, Charlie, you talk to these folks who are leaving, and they come back again and again to Gates and to Marjorie Taylor Greene. And you would think, you know, they're just a handful that are that bad, you know. You throw in Boebert maybe, but as Ramesh explained with his quadrant analysis, because the majority is small, their influence is magnified, and because of the media ecosystem on the right is such as that it is, their influence is magnified, and it's made a lot of the folks who are there for the right reasons completely miserable.
So I am very disappointed once again to hear you rhinos displaying a total lack of imagination as to what's possible here. A lack of imagination that you undoubtedly picked up at those globalist neocon cocktail parties from which you simply can't escape. If we get rid of Mike Johnson, who we thought a few weeks ago was MAGA, but has proven himself to be a rhino, of course, then our victory is inevitable. Within minutes of his being deposed, the House will develop a steely resolve. 10 or more Democratic senators will flip to the Republicans. Joe Biden will publicly give in, maybe resign. And everything conservatives want will be passed, and the country will cheer. And our long national nightmare will be over. And that you can't see it just shows that you're in the pocket of the Chamber of Commerce. I mean, it's stupid, isn't it? When you put it like that, it's just stupid. These people are stupid. They're stupid and divorced from reality. They don't understand the country they live in. They don't know how many seats they have or why. They're not interested in doing any of the work to persuade people to give them a bigger majority. They don't actually seem to want to achieve anything except their own re-election, which in most cases is not in any doubt. They do not understand why it is that the United States is where it is in public policy. It is not because there is a conspiracy. It is not because most Republicans are weak or lily-livered. It's because, by and large, the Congress that we have reflects where the country is, or at least reflects where the country is once elections have been filtered through the candidates that have been chosen. If I were a serious person in Congress, I wouldn't want to be there either. Because they're not actually having arguments. It's not even a matter of losing arguments. They're not having arguments. There's this nihilism here that prevents anyone who wishes to legislate or debate or move the ball or even just represent their faction from doing so meaningfully. It is a hive of name-calling and attention-seeking. So I find it very regrettable that the serious people are leaving, but I understand why. Because there's no resolve, there's no comprehension of what has happened. The Republicans have a tiny majority, which seems to be shrinking by the day, because the Republicans are not that popular. That's the truth of it. Sorry, guys. And Marjorie Taylor Greene is even less popular than the median Republican. Far less popular than the median Republican. That's what it comes down to. And the great irritation here is that the more we do this, the less likely the Republicans are to have the sort of majority that they would then need to use to get what they want. So it's this vicious cycle where all the incentives line up in the wrong direction. And there doesn't seem to be any obvious way out. And now it's having the effect of getting rid of the people who would be able to lead us out of the wilderness. So it seems at the moment completely hopeless.
So Ramesh, I'm going to ask you a double-barreled exit question. But before I do, if Mike Johnson were deposed, is there a next in line after Mike Johnson? Mike Johnson was barely in line the first time around. Who's in line after Mike Johnson? Do we know? Have any idea?
What you need is a Republican with a bottomless appetite for humiliation. and I think that actually there are a number who would suggest themselves.
Could we come back around to like a Scalise or a Jordan?
Yeah, I think that is in fact possible. I mean, it would be, you know, one thing is you would know going in, it's not for life, you know? So you don't have to worry that you're going to be saddled with this person for years and years. Mm-hmm. And that might change the calculus. But, you know, when you think about the incentives, remember Matt Rosendale said that he had prayed, this is Montana Republican congressman, he had prayed that they would get a small House majority because it would maximize the influence of the most conservative faction in the House. So we can dispute whether they're really all that conservative in a way, but you know, he got what he wanted.
Yeah. So that's the good news, right? He's out of that Senate race.
Oh yes. He did get kicked out of the Senate race because somebody prevailed on Trump to go with the person that people consider more electable.
I mean, that's the thing. Trump
is kind of retiring from Congress entirely, isn't he? He's retiring from Congress entirely, isn't he? Rosendale?
I hadn't seen that, but you know, maybe that's the best way to guard your purity.
That's the thing. Trump is kind of statesmanlike compared to some of these characters. So the promised double-barreled exit question to you, Ramesh, is one, a prediction, and then the other will be a value judgment. Prediction, Mike Johnson will be deposed, yes or no. And then the second part, the Republican majority deserves to die. Yes or no?
Mike Johnson will be deposed. It's just a question of when.
This Congress.
It is just a question of when this Congress.
he's definitely going to be deposed.
Yeah. As for whether the House Republican majority deserves to die, one thing I've learned in our long time together at National Review is that dessert has nothing to do with it.
Noah,
it's possible that Mike Johnson will be deposed, but I don't think that's especially likely before the next Congress. Does the Republican majority deserve to die? No, it does not deserve to die. It is committing suicide. The Republicans won the popular vote across the spectrum of House races in 2022. It was the will of the American people that Republicans should balance against Joe Biden, check Joe Biden's influence on government. Republicans are abdicating the duty that was bestowed on them by voters in 2022. So no, they don't deserve to die. They're killing themselves.
Charlie, will Johnson survive and Republicans deserve to die?
I think Johnson will survive. I was extremely critical last time of the Democrats, not because they had created this mess, but because they had an opportunity to keep McCarthy in power, and they didn't take it. They acquiesced to the wishes of the fringe, and then they complained about it, which I thought was dishonorable. I don't think they're going to do that again, because they have watched what has happened this time around. The Republican majority doesn't deserve to die for exactly the reason that Noah outlines. It is not reasonable that one or two members can destroy a base of power that was given by the people. They can do that, and they might, but I don't think there's any deserve about it. I don't think this is some cosmic judgment. So no, it doesn't deserve to die. If you change the question to, do Republicans deserve to be given the majority again? I think that's a little different. I hope they get it, because I think despite all of this nonsense, they are blocking bad policies, but the public may not see it that way.
So I think Johnson will survive for the reason Charlie outlines. And I know, Charlie, you're still sore that I didn't give you supposed credit for your supposed correct prediction or better prediction of the 2020 election than Jim Garrity. But if memory serves, you've been more right on these speaker predictions over the last year than I have. So I'm giving in and just going with your answer, Charlie. I do think he'll survive. And I think they deserve to die. I don't want him to die. I hope they don't. But this has been, what, a ludicrous spectacle. Like nothing we've seen. I don't know. Maybe it happened. There are analogs in the 19th century or something. But it's been a frank embarrassment. With that, let's go to our sponsor of this episode. The University of Austin, or UATX, the newest university in America, is accepting applications now for fall 2024. UATX's founding 100 students will each receive a full tuition scholarship to attend class at the university's downtown campus in the heart of Austin, Texas. UATX is building a new institution grounded in the wisdom of the past and launched towards the knowledge and insight of the future. Students will study the liberal arts and sciences with distinguished faculty and work with Austin mentors who have started companies, pioneered discoveries, and built from the ground up. Visit uaustin.org, that's uaustin.org, to learn more and apply to join the University of Austin's founding freshman class. So Noah, big events going on, seismic stuff at NBC News. Rona McDaniel, the outgoing chairman of the RNC, who was ousted just amazingly easily, one word or Truth Social post or whatever from Donald Trump, and boom, she was gone to be replaced by new, hopefully even more intense loyalist in NBC, who worked with her in planning one of these debates that that NBC did, signed her up. She had an interview already scheduled. It's ridiculous that I know this much about it, but it's been such a huge media story. Meet the Press had previously scheduled an interview with her, not knowing she'd been signed on as a paid contributor. And Kirsten Welker, obviously, like everyone else at NBC, quite offended by the idea that McDaniel would become an NBC contributor. And basically, this is, I don't know how long it was, 10, 15, 20 minute interview, that the subtext of the whole thing was, how can we possibly have you and trust you to be an NBC News contributor? Then they had their panel on immediately after this interview, and Chuck Todd totally blasted the brass at NBC for this decision to sign on McDaniel, which has opened the floodgates. And basically, you're not an NBC or MSNBC anchor or contributor unless you have publicly denounced this decision to sign on McDaniel, who, as far as we know, at the time of this recording, I'm not sure this will still be true, you know, 5 minutes from now, but is still an NBC News contributor. What do you make of it?
So I was an MSNBC contributor for 3 years, roughly. I know a lot of those folks on air. I still have good relationships with them, and I appreciate the work they do. All that being said, this is just an outsized reaction that is utterly divorced from any professional concern that I can identify and share. It's very similar. This reaction is very similar to what we experienced when Mick Mulvaney got a contract with CBS. Almost the same response was devoted to criticizing CBS and him for giving him the platform to have access to American ears because he was associated with the Trump administration. And that's it. Rona McDaniel was associated with Trump's presidency. She held on to that job for far longer than she deserved it. She presided over the loss of the House in 2018, the loss of the presidency in 2020, the loss of the Senate in 2021, and retained her job into 2022 when they underperformed despite significant headwinds. There's no reason why she should have held that position at the RNC, save inertia and the fact that the party has, as we discussed in the last segment, kind of lost its appetite for winning elections. But the notion here that Rona McDaniel represents some unique threat to the NBC brand or is conspicuously devoted to retailing untruths just conflicts with the cable news and news generally effort to elevate communications professionals in White Houses, in national positions of prominence in politics, to contributor contracts. Axios noted that 10 of the last 14 White House press secretaries became cable news figures. Kate Bedingfield is a CNN regular who was on CNN's airways all the time and was implicated in the White House's efforts to massage the Hunter Biden story, Joe Biden's various explanations for his conduct that have proven false in retrospect. Jen Psaki last night, defending her record, quote, talking about Rona McDaniel, she spread lies and called January 6th legitimate political discourse. Look, this isn't about Republicans versus Democrats. This isn't about red versus blue. This is about truth versus lies. Well, Jen Psaki was implicated in retailing a lot of notions about monoclonal antibodies and Florida's response to COVID that proved untrue. She's deeply enmeshed in the Afghanistan debacle, shading, we can say, unfavorably, conversations that Joe Biden had with Afghan President Ghani, retailing notions like Americans were not stranded, and there were only 1,000 or so Americans behind the enemy lines. All this stuff was bunk. It was no obstacle to her ascending to prominence on NBC's airwaves. This is all nonsense. It's all pretextual. What they want to do is exile people who were associated with Donald Trump's presidency from public life. And they're just not going to get away with it, which is why it made sense for NBC's brass to bring her on in the first place. They do need, in fact, this was the logic when I was associated with the network, they need Republican voices to understand the other side of the aisle. When Trump was elected, we had this big national conversation about how we couldn't understand how this happened because we had siloed ourselves in the press from the views of regular Americans. And they're doing it all over again. And they will encounter the same dark night of the soul if Donald Trump is returned to the White House. How did this happen and we missed it? Well, you missed it because you didn't want to see it.
Yeah, so Charlie, they need Republicans. They also need, you know, this is a weird phenomenon. You watch these Sunday shows, if you do, and the listening to the panels, you would think everyone in America is either hostile to, like really actively hostile to Donald Trump or skeptical of him. Like there's no Trump supporter in America. And, you know, I wouldn't go to McDaniel as my first, second, third, or I don't know what the number would get to person I want to hear comment on politics. And I get being appalled by the election denialism, but people like this need to be represented, in my view, somewhere in the comma Tariot, and including on these shows, but at NBC, it looks like they're not going to abide it.
No, and I read this morning that executives at NBC are currently discussing what to do, given the scale of the pushback from their own staff, so she may not ever start. My problem here is that, like Noah, I think this is completely disingenuous. This is not because I believe Rona McDaniel to be someone of great charisma and insight. She's not. if I were choosing somebody to represent conservatives or even just partisan Republicans on television, I would not pick her. It's not either because I don't have a problem with the way the Trump administration often behaved, especially around the 2020 election. I do, and I do think that there is a case to be made that we should separate out apparatchiks from commentators, and that we should treat Trump apparatchiks differently than everyone else. The problem I have is that I see absolutely no interest at NBC, or frankly anywhere else, in hiring the sort of people that those who make those cases pretend they want. They're not going after the so-called good Republicans. They're not trying to find eloquent, charismatic, honest conservatives to present the views that are held by around half the country. At no point in any of these Jeremiah ads did any of those people say, and here is who we should have hired, or, and it's important, of course, to reflect the political views of 100 or so million people. And that's because they don't want those views reflected. It's not that every criticism of Ronald McDaniel is untrue. It's that this is pretextual. This is a perfect way of rejecting the purity that the stations want. I saw Peter Spiliakos on Twitter put this perfectly when he said that the argument that's being made here is very cleverly constructed, because what the people who are making it are trying to do is simultaneously contend that this election that we are about to have is not a both sides question, but hold on to, or try to hold on to, the cachet that came with the media in the 1970s and 1980s and before. They know that they can't say one half of the country's view should not be represented. So instead, they latch on to sometimes correct criticisms of individuals or of people within the movement. But they never fill in the second part of the form, which is, okay, who do you want instead? And that's because they don't want anyone. And it's obvious, but they think we can't see it.
Ramesh.
So Nicole Wallace yesterday, as part of the seemingly ritual denunciation of the McDaniel hire from a lot of the MSNBC on-air talent, brought Timothy Snyder's book on tyranny and was quoting from it before saying that it, you know, basically McDaniel would pollute, quote, our sacred airwaves at NBC. And it's hard not to laugh, because these people are combining this air of being part of a resistance to incipient tyranny, right? That's the self-conception of people like Wallace, with what is essentially a rejection from the clubhouse, right? I mean, they're saying, you know, as a group, we don't want you, and they're sort of exerting peer pressure on each other to make the same kind of declaration. At the same time, it's hard to have a lot of sympathy for McDaniel. In her interview on Meet the Press, she basically admitted that she had said things about the 2020 election that she didn't think were true, because she felt it was necessary for her job, which seems to me to be, you know, the kind of thing which should keep you from staying in that job. You're not under a moral obligation to say everything you believe, but I do think you're under an obligation not to say things you don't believe. But also, she was sort of trying to have it both ways. And you do wonder, look, I mean, I don't want to be too mean about this, but has anybody ever said, wow, you know, Ronna McDaniel, she had real insight that she brought to this situation that you can't get from anybody else? Mm-hmm. You know, what's the value added? She doesn't even, in terms of your thoughts about representing, you know, true blue Trumpers don't think of her as one of them. They were, you know, they were delighted.
Now.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they sort of turned on a dime, which is one of the reasons why it's kind of hard to get them represented. And so she's in a no man's land at this moment, doesn't really have a fan base. And I would be sad for her if she hadn't been the author of her own misfortunes.
So that's a segue to the double barrel. I'm going to double barrel it once again. X question to you, Noah. One, the Meet the Press interview was the last time that McDaniel will appear on NBC News' air. Yes or no? And two, rate your level of schadenfreude over this episode zero. You think it's sad for everyone. You feel very sorry for Nicole Walls and for Rona McDaniel. 10, you're taking absolute delight and not even caring over this ridiculous drama.
Well, for the first one, I'm going to bet that McDaniel will survive.
Whoa.
But it'll take a while. If only because that's the trajectory that Mick Mulvaney was on. And the reason why Mick Mulvaney was on that trajectory is because he proved himself to be relatively independently minded and kind of milquetoast as a contributor to the network. And then McDaniel, now freshly liberated from her responsibilities at the RNC, is on that same pathway where she's saying, oh, you know, January 6th was pretty bad, right?
They're not hostages. That's
the not hostages. We shouldn't let them out of jail. So yeah, she's on a redemption tour herself. So I think she survives after a whole lot of emotional energy is devoted to venting about the frustrations with her on that network. Second, schadenfreude. The way you phrased it suggests I should care for the plight that is being endured by my friends Chuck Todd and Nicole Wallace, for example, and I do not. I do not share their frustrations. I think they're relatively unwarranted. I don't take much pleasure in it, though. It's just kind of a curiosity.
So what's your number? You have 5?
I guess a 5, I suppose. Five? I don't know. I feel nothing. Five. I'm dead inside.
Charlie, will McDaniel survive and rate your schadenfreude?
I think that McDaniel will not survive. I think the rejection has been almost complete. In terms of my schadenfreude or lack thereof, I hope I'm wrong and that she does survive, because I need her to be in the building when the asteroid hits. And then all of those people are in the blink of an eye wiped out. It's not that I am taking sides here. I hate all of them. And thus, this is a perfect story for me because I can watch it with great delight.
Are you a 10? 10?
Well, I'm an 8, but if the asteroid breaks through the clouds, I will definitely be a 10, maybe even an 11.
Ramesh.
She won't survive this. This is it's too many people are invested in her not surviving it. And I would say I'm at about an 8.
Yeah, I'm about a 7 or an 8. I grade down a little bit on my schadenfreude for it. It's just not. I'm slightly annoyed having to pay attention to it. Otherwise, it's completely delightful. And no, she won't survive. I mean, just what show will have her? I mean, they can keep paying her a reported $300,000 a year, but no one's going to have her. She's going to be on the Meet the Press again or on MSNBC Prime.
Well, that's the only place you ever see Steve Hayes, for example.
Yeah,
there are very few outlets for Republicans at NBC anymore, save MTP.
Yeah, but you know, it seems like after Sunday, they're really going to have her. After having, you know, Chuck Todd, a pretty big voice at NBC, denounce her on the very show. So
she can take one for the team again.
Yeah. All right. So let's pause. Let me do a quick plug for Enter Plus, digital subscription service at nationalreview.com. Your way around our metered paywall. Your way if you sign up and log in to see about 90% fewer ads. Your way if you want to. You don't have to comment on our articles and blog posts and get invited to exclusive events and calls with the writers, editors, and other conservative figures. And most importantly, it's a really crucial way to support our journalism. So if you're not already a member, if you are a member, thank you. Really appreciate it. If you're not a member, please consider joining tens of thousands of your fellow National Review readers and becoming one today, tomorrow, or the day after, or if you must procrastinate, maybe even the day after that. So Charlie, last week we had this new rule on electric vehicles. The federal government, without any congressional action, can apparently just pick out of a hat what percentage of electric cars people are going to be buying in the year 2032. This rule was relatively relaxed from the initial version. The CO2 emission restrictions are slightly less taxing, but still the idea is to get people out of their internal combustion cars. I think pure EV sales now are like a little over 7% of the market You know, all honor to Elon Musk. He made a great product. It's made major inroads in the luxury market, car market, which is no small thing. But most people who are buying those cars, they have a garage where they can charge overnight. They have disposable income, and they're buying it as a second or third car because it's a fun and interesting car. On the other hand, internal combustion engines are amazing. They transformed our lives. They transformed America. They're incredibly reliable and convenient. You can go to this thing called a gas station. There are a million gas pumps in America. And, you know, 5 minutes or less, you are good to go. You're not standing around a charging station for hours. And this is among the reasons that this rule seems as though it's going to be destined to fail, but at the very least is extremely foolhardy.
I hate this in every way it's possible to hate it. Another asteroid would be welcome here. The
special asteroid episode of the editors.
I don't think that the federal government should be telling me which cars I can buy and which I can't. I don't think that the underlying law here was designed to enable this level of interference. I expect it to be litigated. And I don't think that the Biden administration's read on the market is correct. Teslas are equivalent, in my estimation, to Apple products, which is to say they are cool and desirable and different than milquetoast computers. You cannot apply the same market analysis to a Tesla as you would to another EV. I don't have a Tesla, but I could imagine myself having one because it's full of interesting and exciting technology. But I don't want, and certainly wouldn't as a result of that marginal interest in a Tesla, want to trade out my wife's Ford Explorer for an electric Ford Explorer. Mm-hmm. They're not the same thing.
The reason why I can't get a Tesla, Charlie, is I'd have to call you every time something was not working.
I wouldn't understand it. I wouldn't mind that. But the idea that because Elon Musk produced a car that is exciting and cool and new, that people who drive Ford Explorers or Toyota Corollas are going to want those cars to be electric is bizarre. And they don't, if you look at the market. So this is an intervention from the top. This is not trying to track consumer behavior or public sentiment. It is a shift based on climate alarmism. It is also a shift that is being dishonestly sold. The rule here is that by 2032, that's 8 years from now, 67% of all vehicles sold in the United States will have to be electric. Now, I believe that there is a concession in there that includes hybrids within that. The Biden administration says, we are not picking a particular technology and therefore our action is not ultra vires. That's not really true, given that the way that this rule is written implies electric cars or hybrid cars. But even if it were true, you cannot play with markets like this and expect everything in those markets to stay the same. If you mandate that automakers shift their production on aggregate to 67% electric, you are going to fundamentally change the market for gasoline cars. It's not as if that will remain on the same level as it currently is. The factories will have to change. The price of gasoline cars will have to change. The supply chains will have to change. The investment in gas stations will have to change. Once you hit 67%, you're not, it is true, banning petroleum vehicles, but you are making their production much more difficult, much more expensive. You are marginalizing them. You're making them a minority product. You're making them almost the product of a dilettante. I think this is crazy, unwarranted behavior that will, I assume, be pushed back and back and back and back in implementation in the same way that, say, Real ID has, because it's just not workable. It's not the product of anything other than central planning, or as we euphemistically call it, industrial policy. But this should be litigated, and it should be reversed by the next president who is not Joe Biden, because it is utterly inconsistent with reality.
Yeah. So Ramesh, you know, electric cars have their place. And again, nothing wrong with people buying Teslas, and plug-in hybrids. Seems as though there's market potential there. You're not going all one way. You have both alternatives. But just to underline Charlie's point, to replace, like, you know, we're going to take 150,000 or whatever it is filling stations and replace them with the gas pumps, or a lot of the gas pumps, with electric chargers. And to get Mark Mills wrote a great paper on this for the Manhattan Institute. He's now gone out and founded his own center on energy analytics. But you need these superchargers that can charge in like 20 minutes, which is still like a very long time, an extremely long time when you're going somewhere and compared to gas. And then the amount of electricity these things take. And when you're dealing with huge volume, it's much easier to move energy and oil through pipelines and tanks than it is to get this amount of energy over the wires. So it's just an enormous undertaking, and you're destroying or downgrading something that's working just fine. So they engage in this classic kind of Bastiat economic era, where it's wow, this is so great for our economy. We're creating something, building something that's totally new. But the other side of the equation is you're destroying or downgrading something that works just fine. It's extremely efficient and convenient.
So I have great confidence in, and would not rule out the possibility that markets and science can solve these sorts of practical problems. But I don't think that a government edict can conjure those solutions into being according to a political timetable. And that, it seems to me, is the central error that is being made here. But there's also a political error. This policy seems to me like as though somebody around President Biden had decided to illustrate every problem that Rui Teixeira has been raising the alarm about the Democrats for the last 3 years. It is something that harms material interests of the vast majority of Americans, and does so on the basis of sort of very notional gains on the other side. It is something that can easily be presented as a kind of punitive liberalism, a kind of war on the American way of life. Charlie mentioned that, you know, his hope that this is litigated, but it should also be made into a political issue. And if Biden had a competent opposition, it would be.
So now another element of this is these electric cars, one of the case for them is that they're much simpler than gas-powered cars, but the batteries are not simple and depend on all these rare earths and other minerals that China has gobbled up and has control of the mining of and the processing of. So one of the rationales is, wow, we really need to do electric vehicles so we don't fall behind China. At the same time, this mad rush to electric vehicles is going to make us more dependent on Chinese supply chains.
When you make an environmental activist describe what it takes to make a lithium-ion battery, you encounter a level of cognitive dissonance that is irreconcilable. It's like giving a robot in a Star Trek episode, you know, one of those insolvable conundrums, and then just sparks start flying out of their head. It's an atrocious process. It involves strip mining, profound destabilization of local environments. A lot of it happens in the global south. And this is applicable across the board. This EV mandate should be read as part of a broader attack on consumer choice and convenience, not just by the Biden administration, but Democrat-led states and municipalities more broadly. They are making it prohibitive for you to own small two-stroke engines, the kind of stuff that goes into lawnmowers and leaf blowers. They are making it prohibitively expensive to heat your home with natural gas or use gas ranges or have a hookup that involves gas range that allows you to have gas appliances in your new constructed building. They're making it inaccessible to have plastic shopping bags in my state. You can no longer have filament bulbs. If you want a high flow plumbing fixture, you're out of luck. They say that this is all to stimulate markets and create some sort of new growth. But it is an inefficient allocation of capital because it distorts the market. A lot of these things cost more money, which takes the opportunity to invest that money in more efficient economic activities away from consumers. It doesn't incept new competitive sectors. It incepts non-competitive sectors and then subsidizes them to make them competitive, because otherwise they are not. It should be understood as as Ramesh said, an attack on consumer choice and an effort to engineer society in ways that the market would not otherwise support, and all for a particularly dubious rationale, the notion that American energy consumption materially contributes to the amount of heat-trapping emissions in the atmosphere, which if you dig down into the data, really isn't very well supported. So it's all this weird myopia that is just shared by the Democratic political class and no one else. And they impose this on consumers in ways they increasingly resent. You know, the Biden administration is so fixated on Michigan because they think, you know, they're going to lose the election just because of Israel, without devoting any concern to what they're doing to auto manufacturers. You know, a lot of auto manufacturers are in the American South now. But those automakers are not fond of these EV mandates. They make it known to anybody willing to listen, and the Biden administration is just not willing to listen. The consequences of their decisions will come home to them faster than I think they anticipate.
So, Charlie, I ask a question to you, coming back to something you mentioned. So, hypothetically, you get an offer to trade in, to be given, and to replace your car and or cars with a Tesla and or Teslas. Just you get whatever you're driving now, it's replaced with a Tesla, this amazing luxury car that purrs like a kitten. You take that deal, yes or no?
Absolutely not. Also, they don't purr like kittens. They make no noise at all. This is one of the things I hate about electric cars. I don't mind if other people want them. And I should remind you that I drive a golf cart, which is the OG electric car, when traveling locally.
You could have a Tesla for that golf cart and you're not taking it?
No.
I should say all vehicles.
Well, I want a golf cart for a reason, not least that I built that golf cart and I maintain it myself and it does exactly what I want to do. So Tesla is a glorified computer, which is great, but I want to be able to have at least one vehicle that I can fix myself. But no, I'm not replacing my cars with electric cars. Absolutely not.
Ramesh.
I'm going to answer for Charlie. He is going to take the Tesla, he's going to resell it, and he's going to buy himself many golf carts.
But part of the pleasure was making the golf carts, not just purchase them, right, Charlie?
That's right.
Well, you can buy even more material to make them, yeah.
You know, I understand, sorry to jump in here, but I understand that this is a matter of taste. And I also understand that what I'm about to say is probably not going to be the best line of argument overall against these mandates. But I resent this in addition to all of the reasons that I gave, because I like cars. Mm-hmm. And to me, with the exception of a couple of electric cars that I have seen that are pretty cool, electric cars are anodyne. They are the rejection of what it is that I like about cars.
Yeah, so Charlie, let me ask you about that, because I wrote a column about cars for today, and I'm not a car guy, as you know, but a lot of people are. What accounts for that connection that people feel to a car?
That's a great question. Part of it for me, as somebody who is very aural and grew up in a musical environment, is the noise. There is a response that a car gives. I'm not talking about the speed, because electric cars have great acceleration for lots of boring technical reasons, but the sound that a car makes you feel as if you are in concert with it. And having driven a bunch of electric cars, that disappears. And I don't think it's an accident that we as a culture make movies all the time about cars and we focus on the sound. I just watched one last week, this movie Ferrari by Michael Mann, not the bad Michael Mann, the good Michael Mann. There was a movie about Lamborghini I saw last year, one of the best movies.
Terrible movie with Ryan Gosling. He said about 8 words the whole movie and just drove around. I think he was a getaway guy or something. But it was basically a movie about the car.
Well, a fabulous movie was a few years ago was Ford v Ferrari. I mean, we like these cars, you know, the classic movies, Days of Thunder, all of that. We like it. We take time to film it. We take time to record the engine. We like the rising note, which then kicks down after each gear. People go see this in the movie theater. They put it in surround sound. They turn the volume up. we like this. It's aspirational. There are lots of different reasons.
You're leaving out the most important car movie of all time, obviously.
Which is?
Fast and Furious. Matt Brown right now, if he's listening, Fast and Furious, guys, come on.
Yeah, my joke with that is I prefer the novel. But the thing with electric cars is, and I'm not saying this is true of every car, and it's certainly not true of Tesla, which is why people like them. But so much of the push toward electric cars, as it comes from government and environmental groups, is predicated upon a dislike of cars. It's an attempt to neutralize and pour bleach over what it is that people like about cars. And Ramesh is right. People are going to hate that.
Noah, you get the free Teslas. You take them?
Absolutely not. not because I'm a big car guy and I have, you know, really well-formulated opinions about cars. I don't really care. They're conveyance from one destination to the next. But I would add to Charlie's observation that if you look at this as I do from the prism of this attack on consumer choice, it's not just that they don't like cars, it's that they don't like people. They don't trust people, certainly. If I would say that there's a reason why Americans have such an affection for cars, it is the physical expression of liberty. It allows you to go wherever you want to go, whenever you want to go. You are not beholden to anyone. You're not beholden to roads, necessarily, if you so choose. That's under attack, from auto driving to the notion that you can install breathalyzers in vehicles to auto disabling cars, and now to you being hostage to electric charging stations. All that liberty is being taken away slowly because they don't trust the social engineers, the regulators, the bureaucrats. They don't trust people to behave appropriately with these things that people have been using now for the better part of a century, and it's worked out all right. Yeah. It's a broader malady of just general distrust for the American consumer.
And travel by land, just historically, was the worst thing. I mean, it was just awful. Even if you're wealthy and privileged, it was miserable. And trains alleviated that somewhat, but they're obviously
we should go
limited.
Back to litters. And just yeah, have people exactly. just being carried
yeah.
on that.
Yeah,
on
when they carried platform. Caesar to the Senate to get assassinated, he was on a litter. But I'm sure it wasn't very pleasant, actually, to be in a litter. Maybe better than walking, but still, you'd rather to be even in the worst electric car than in a litter. I'm not a car guy. Our cars work just fine, thank goodness. I would not take the Tesla deal either. And in part because I hate the door handles of Teslas. They feel fragile to me. They feel they're not intuitive, and that would bother me every time I open.
And the key is a credit card that you're supposed mm-hmm. to put like on the dashboard, which flies off when you're driving. It's a frustration of mine.
All right, so let's hit a few other things before we go. Ramesh, you went to Jurassic World Live.
I did, and it was everything that you could hope that a drama could be involving velociraptors and troodonts. Mm-hmm. But the most important member of my retinue was my 5-year-old son, and I think he would see that every day, possibly more than once, mm-hmm. if he could.
So, Noah, yet another celebration in the Rothman household. I'm featuring hundreds, I'm sure.
Not at all. No, not this time, because it was inside. Yeah, at the risk of playing into a stereotype here, we did have a party for my wife, who turns 40 this week. Last past weekend, we had a 90s-themed party. So I went to my parents' house and dug up in the attic and got all these artifacts from the decade and, you know, threw them around, Nintendo cartridges and an old... a plug-in phone that was made out of Legos and fun stuff like that. And yeah, probably about 30, 40, but we got a keg, which I don't think I've even seen in the last 20 years. It was.
And you had solo cups, I hope.
It's solo cups. We made a playlist that, you know, 1990 to 1999. It was very thematic. And
you got to have an NR party, Noah. I'd be happy to, outside.
Outside.
Do people not use solo cups anymore? Is that a 90s thing?
Well, the solo cups are definitely...
If you have a keg, you need solo cups.
Yeah, right. That's it. That was just it. Red solo cups, too.
Exactly. Got to do it right. Charlie, you've been watching Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency.
I have. The British version of the show with Stephen Mangan. They only made 4 episodes, which I find inexplicable because it was extremely well done. it wasn't faithful to the books in the storylines, but it was certainly faithful to the books in its affect. I wish they had made more, but unfortunately, the series ended, I think, 12 years ago, so it seems unlikely they're going to go back to that well. I don't know where you can find this show, but find it, you should.
So I love the NCAA tournament. When a first round is close to me, I make a point to go. I went for the Friday afternoon session in Brooklyn, saw FAU lose in overtime to Northwestern, and UConn utterly wipe out Stetson. It was a lot of fun, and I just love the first 4 days of this tournament. After that, I get a little tired, and usually the underdogs have all been eliminated by that point, so it's a little less interesting, but it has been it was a great first 4 days. With that, it's time for our editor's picks. Ramesh, what's your pick?
The forthcoming issue of National Review includes an article by our friend and colleague Andrew Stuttiford about the rising resistance to net zero throughout the developed world. And I think it is something that would be a good companion to our discussion about the electric vehicle mandate.
All right. Noah, what's your pick?
A lovely essay by Abigail Anthony, Unplugged, which she describes getting rid of her phone, being phone-free for a jaunt to Italy. She's currently studying in Oxford, and she's in Europe, so she was zigzagging around Europe phone-free. Interestingly, she had she experienced more of a sense of deprivation for not having the tools associated with her phone, like the flashlight, for example, and I hadn't thought of that. I'm increasingly of her inclination towards phones. I really like to disconnect over the weekends. All the connectivity features I find just intrusive increasingly. But I still have it on me, and I'm still using it for all the various tools that are associated with it. So I'm sure I would lose those and I would miss them. But I share Abigail's sentiment in this piece. It's a good piece. Go read it.
Charlie, what's your pick?
I'm going to pick two pieces. They're back to back. They're both by Dominic Pino, and they both cut straight through all the nonsense. And although they're not directly related, they are related in the sense that they highlight how so much of our debate over our fiscal policy is nonsense. Dominic filled in for Jim Garrity in the Morning Jolt with a post titled, "We Can't Say We Weren't Warned," laying out the new budget projections from the CBO. And then he added to our editorial on the Biden administration's proposed housing tax credits by pointing out that, properly understood, they are a tax cut for the rich. And it seems to me, I'm really here just trying to praise Dominic's writing in general, which is fabulous, but these two things are related in that our political rhetoric and our economic realities just don't seem to touch very much at the moment. And I have found few people able to highlight that as well as Dominic Pino.
So sticking with the NCAA theme, my pick is by our great Buckley fellow, Haley Strack, titled Roll Chargers, about how the Hillsdale Chargers had a couple key players in the tournament, including most notably Jack Golke, who was with Oakland. And this guy is just insane. He had 350 shots roughly in the regular season, 340 of them were three-pointers. And the first game that Oakland won, unfortunately, they fell in overtime the second game. But the first game, he hit, I believe it was 10 threes, just from all over the place, like low-percentage threes, high-percentage threes, if there's such a thing. Didn't matter. He was just hitting them all over the place, and it was great to see. So that's it for us. Finally, I believe, got a minute and a half or so, under an hour, because Ramesh is so lapidary. You've been listening to a National Review podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written permission of National Review Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Noah. Thank you, Ramesh. Thanks to the University of Austin, and thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.